This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Bomb threats, desecration of cemeteries. We'll hear from the Jewish Federation.
We are living in a time when civility is very low, when everything and everyone is deeply divided.
Then a project is looking to virtually recreate Detroit's Black Bottom neighborhood.
The neighborhood north of Black Bottom was called Paradise Valley, and the two neighborhoods had everything you could want, from a dentist to a nightclub.
And 80 years ago, a white supremacist group terrorized immigrants who they thought were stealing their jobs.
So to tell those people that immigrants are the threat to your economic security, it was something that some people were willing to listen to.
Plus, we talk with Michigan's chief economist, who's retiring today, about whether term-limited politicians really understand state finances and other interesting things. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. After 36 years, Michigan's chief economist is retiring. We'll talk with Jay Wortley about term limits, taxation, and giving advice to politicians. But first, attacks and threats to minority communities have been escalating. For instance, Jewish community centers across America got intimidating calls. Then in St. Louis and Philadelphia, Jewish cemeteries were vandalized. And this week, bomb threats were phoned into several Jewish centers and schools, including Ann Arbor's Hebrew Day School. Dave Stuhlman is the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Ann Arbor, and he joins us now. How is the Jewish community reacting to these escalating threats and the vandalism we've seen?
Hi, Lester. I think the Jewish community is becoming more and more concerned. We've been watching anti-Semitism grow for a long time, mostly confined to Europe, but in the last year or so, growing as well across the United States. What happened yesterday, and I believe in total 24 Jewish community centers, Jewish day schools, et cetera, received bomb threats yesterday. It was the fifth wave. Since January 19th, there have been, I believe, 88 bomb threats to Jewish institutions.
Yeah, the Anti-Defamation League said 90.
Could be 90. I haven't seen if there's any more today, but it wouldn't surprise me. When they're not phoning in bomb threats, the cemetery desecrations in Philadelphia or in St. Louis, or simply hateful graffiti and phone calls are coming in all across the country.
I have to ask you about the kids yesterday. How are they taking this? It's got to be kind of a frightening thing to be evacuated from the school.
The kids are fine. We are fortunate. We have both the Jewish Federation of Ann Arbor plus the Hebrew Day School are co-located inside the Jewish Community Center building. We have about 175 children under the age of 11 in the building at any given time. Our staff are absolutely terrific. We have great protocols. We practice them all of the time. And for the very little kids, I think it's just an unexpected field trip. They go to an undisclosed location where there are games and lots of things to for them to do and entertain them. The older kids are merely, you know, told for purposes of safety, we're going to leave for a while and then we're going to come back. And then the day school staff is trained to speak with them afterwards. We have great communications with the parents, and things go extremely smoothly.
Why do you think there's this spike in anti-Semitic actions?
I think that partially it is reflective of what goes on across the country. And people who follow this note that Jews very much reflect the greater United States in attitudes and reactions. And we are living in a time when civility is very low, when everything and everyone is deeply divided. And I think that there has been an allowance, let's call it, since this presidential campaign, in which attacking others, either physically, verbally, in any other way, has become the norm. And there is an unleashing of hate that we haven't seen in a long time.
And that's the point that really startles me. This harkens back to 1930s sort of behavior, where they're going after Jews as well as Muslims, Hispanics, and these two Asian Indian guys who were shot in Kansas. I just don't understand where this is coming from in such a rapid form.
I'm no expert in national politics, but there has been a policy of guarding against others that we have seen in the anti-immigration and other things. There's been a sense of make America great again is something, a statement that in itself kind of excludes people who are seen as outsiders. For many people in America, an outsider is anybody who's a minority. And I think we're just seeing a lot of this is somehow people thinking they have permission coming from the national government, because we're not really seeing any real pushback against it.
Although we should say that President Trump did say something when the Jewish centers were attacked a couple of days later, perhaps, but he did say
right,
something.
Right, but so he said it was horrible. Terrific. You know, I think his statement was shorter than a 140-character tweet. That's not the same. I think, I hope, first of all, in his address tonight that he will speak about this. But I'm not just talking about anti-Semitism. I am talking about the loss of civility, the inability for people to speak with each other. And unfortunately, I also think that a lot of the way people are reacting to President Trump feeds this as well. I am personally not in support of characterizing opposition to President Trump as resistance. I think we're in this situation because for so long, one political party has been resisting anything that another political party has done, and this has traveled down to society. Instead of talking about resisting whoever is in power, why don't we talk about trying to work with and change the attitudes of people who are in power? Coming together for a cause is a much more productive manner of approaching something than resisting it at all costs.
David Stuhlman is the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Ann Arbor. Thanks for coming in and talking with us.
My pleasure.
Let's turn now to another group that's been subject to threats and worse. Qasem Ali is the executive administrator of Islamic Center of America. What is the mood in your community right now?
Hello, Lester. The mood in our community really is one of anxiety. We have been subjected to a number of different incidents over the last several weeks, and there are local incidents and as well as some incidents nationally. So there is a general anxiety, and we are addressing it the best we can.
I understand you've received some threatening calls. What kind of things are said?
Well, I mean, there have been some calls related to Sharia and how Sharia is not compatible with the Constitution, that type of thing. And, you know, we address those calls with information and with an open mind, and we try to have an open heart and try to convince people that some of the information they receive online and in the media is not correct, and we try to inform them of what the reality is with regard to Islam and Sharia and the Constitution.
Well, tell us exactly what you say when you're responding to an accusation like Sharia is not compatible with a constitutional nation.
Well, we basically let them know that Islam is totally compatible with the Constitution. We have, obviously, a faith that teaches us certain traditions, certain rules and practices that we must abide by based on our traditional faith, not unlike the Jewish community, not unlike the Catholic and Christian community. And we have a faith that is peaceful and accepting and really is one that embraces peace and embraces diversity.
So for you, Sharia is religious law, not a substitute for civic law?
Of course. I mean, religious law is something that we personally follow and have embraced as a faith tradition that guides our lives.
How receptive are these people who call in to a response like that?
Some are very perceptive. Some call out of ignorance, really searching for information. And we provide that. Our core mission is to educate people about our faith. And we have had some great success doing that. Unfortunately, there are those who are not as accepting and really called to intimidate us and to bully us. And, you know, we try to handle those with open mind and with open hearts as well. There are some, unfortunately, who are not receptive to that type of approach, and we let the authorities handle it if it becomes threatening.
Any idea who these callers are or whether they're local people?
Typically, they're not local. There are a few that are local, but the majority are not local. We have a very mature, I believe, community in the Detroit metro area that is open-minded, that is mature in its approach to interfaith relations. And, you know, we have been a part of that for going on 50 years now.
There have been incidents, though. I mean, last year we heard about a woman, a Muslim woman, in a grocery store being accosted in Dearborn. Recently, Dearborn's had some incidents with men armed with rifles marching down the sidewalk. Two people wearing masks, wearing body armor, and carrying weapons walked into the Dearborn police station. In the past, people have held Islamophobic protests carrying insulting signs. How does your community respond to those kinds of antagonisms?
Well, we take each one in context. Obviously, we are very concerned about the overall spike in these types of threats and these incidents, and we are addressing them individually with our law enforcement community, whether it's on the local level or the federal level. You know, we embrace civil rights and freedom of speech. However, we will protect our own civil rights and our own freedom of speech and our own ability to practice our faith. And we won't be bullied, we won't be intimidated, but we also, you know, want to, as a part of our mission, protect our community from intimidation and from bullying.
Qasim Ali is the executive administrator of Islamic Center of America. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Downtown Detroit is in a revival, but neighborhoods across the city are still declining. One of the reasons is the onslaught of tax foreclosures. That leaves more vacant houses. Soon the house is stripped and the destruction affects the whole block. As part of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I visited one neighborhood to see what people are doing there.
I'll take you down to the south side.
Ulysses Jones is showing me around his neighborhood, Morningside, on Detroit's east side. He's with a community organization also called Morningside.
Well, this section of Morningside, the southeast section, was primary area for Habitat.
Habitat for Humanity.
Yes. And also with Youth Snapback.
It's a couple of blocks of pretty new row houses. It kind of looks like the suburbs. Then we reach the end of the block. The last house is vacant.
One of the Habitat houses, I think, that have been ransacked. The door's missing. And it's unsecured.
So it doesn't take much of a hint for scrappers to move in?
No.
This is a big problem in Morningside and just about every neighborhood in Detroit. If there's the slightest clue that the house is empty, scrappers descend. Once that happens, the chances of someone buying the house and making it a home again are slim.
You know, if they strip it to the point where somebody might not want it, you know, it's just going to sit there. So we made it our business to watch out for that house.
That's Lenora McElrath. She lives on a block of brick Tudors and bungalows. But there are vacant houses on her block. She says she and her neighbors watch constantly to make sure scrappers don't break into them.
You know, because we question them. Can I help you? If you know no one lives there, you know, you ask questions. Can I help you? When dealing with these situations, I don't necessarily like to be confrontational because, you know, I'm up in age. But when you come into my neighborhood and you think you're going to get away with doing something, that's not happening.
She and her neighbors make the vacant houses appear lived in. They mow the lawns, trim the bushes, pick up leaflets. Every year, hundreds of homes in Morningside end up being auctioned off by the government. In any given year, about one out of five of the more than 4,000 homes are at risk of foreclosure. Last year, 800 were potential foreclosures. 300 homes actually ended up being auctioned. The others arranged last-minute payments. Jackie Grant keeps track of the numbers. She's worked with Loveland Technologies, which monitors every parcel of property in the city. She says in her neighborhood, unemployment is chronically twice that of the state average.
predatory lending led to mortgage foreclosures. Then Detroit's municipal bankruptcy cut retired city workers' pensions, hurting their ability to keep up with their tax bills.
All of that played into that. That's when I think a lot of homes really begin to be lost.
Many of the investors who buy the properties don't secure them, don't resell them, don't rent them. They just sit there until scrappers arrive.
After it ravages the neighborhood, all of these things, right, and the scrappers, it reduces our property values to literally nothing.
Back at Lenora McElrath's, we take a walk around the block. Last year, the city said it would demolish some of the houses that are beyond saving. They're still standing. The windows are broken and the buildings are deteriorating quickly. McElrath says when she moved here 23 years ago, she was struck by the beauty of her neighborhood.
The first thing I noticed was all the trees. It was just beautiful. And it's going down, but we're not going to give up. That's the big thing, not giving up.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
In today's Free Press, there is an article titled Bringing Detroit's Black Bottom Back to Virtual Life. It was written by Bill McGraw, and he joins me now. You were busy doing research, and you came across a project by Emily Kudel. And what's she doing?
Emily Kudel is a young architect in Detroit, and she chanced across a cache of over 800 photos of a neighborhood that's long gone, totally obliterated, Black Bottom, which was on the site basically where Lafayette Park is today, on the east side of downtown. And she is someone who's into geography and in the history of Detroit, and she's also obviously very good with a computer. And she's stitching together these hundreds of photos to create a like Google street scene of pre-1950 Detroit for this neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
And so she's bringing back a neighborhood that not only is it's a neighborhood, but it is the neighborhood where many African Americans, not only in Detroit, but in Southeast Michigan, trace their roots to.
I want to talk about that a little further, too. There's some concern about when it was done away with and what happened to all the wealth. But before I get to that, where did she find these photos?
In the Burton Historical Collection of the Detroit Public Library. Now, the Burton curators knew they were there, but for decades, the photos sat in a warehouse. They were moved to the Detroit Public Library, which is the one by Wayne State across from the DIA, several years ago. And one of the people at the Burton told me that when they started opening the boxes and going through them, they realized they had gold on their hands,
right.
That it was really interesting. And what the photos are from, when they condemned the land in 1950, 49, 50, 51, the city had to take pictures for the court cases where they argue with the owners of the land or of the houses and the buildings how much they're going to be compensated in the eminent domain case. So that's where the photos originally came from. A couple of photographers wandered through the neighborhood snapping photos.
I was talking to historian Ken Coleman, and he says, in fact, he was quoted in your piece, as I recall, he says a lot of black businesses, a lot of black wealth was lost when Black Bottom was destroyed because of urban renewal. How important was this area to African Americans?
Well, it was really important. It became an African American neighborhood in the World War I era during what they call the Great Migration, when many black Americans came from the South to the North for jobs. And so, and it originally was a real multicultural neighborhood, but it became essentially a black ghetto, really, when the color line hardened in Detroit in the World War I and the post-World War I era. So this was one of the few neighborhoods black Detroiters could live in during the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and to some extent, the early 50s.
Now, you say ghetto, but some of the pictures show some pretty nice houses and excellent buildings.
That's you got to be careful with that word. It was a ghetto in a sense that African Americans were forced to live there. They created a very vibrant world. There's absolutely no doubt about it. The neighborhood north of Black Bottom was called Paradise Valley.
Right.
And the two neighborhoods had everything you could want, from a dentist to a nightclub. And it was a very vibrant area. If that area existed today, It would be really sought after homes and probably a really vibrant neighborhood district. Now, what happened was in 1950, when they condemned this land, many of the people who lived there were renters, and they were just told, you're going to go. So these Black Detroiters were forced out of their homes very fairly suddenly and told to go find another home in a city where they were very restricted where they could live.
Sure, so all
they
this redlining and...
Exactly. Yeah. And if they went into, even in the 1950s and early 60s, if they went into a lot of white neighborhoods, they were met with mob violence. And so they had to go to certain neighborhoods, including the 12th Street area, where the rents were higher than they should have been for some of the housing. So it was a really, it's a really interesting lesson when you explore this in the segregationist nature of Detroit housing in the past.
Let me switch gears on you, because you ran into Emily Kudel's photography project because you were doing research for the upcoming Free Press documentary called 12th and Claremont. What's that about?
12th and Claremont is the Free Press's video documentary about what happened in Detroit in July of 1967. It's also about what led up to the riot or the rebellion and what happened right afterwards. And it's done by, I'm helping them, but it's done by the Free Press video unit, which has won all sorts of national awards, is one of the leading American newspapers in doing online documentaries.
What's going to make this documentary different than others about the 1967 uprising?
Well, I don't think there's been a lot of documentaries. There's been a lot of news reports and extended reports, on what happened in July of 67. This is going to have people's home movies that people have been sending in to the DIA. There's a lot of partners in this, including Bridge Magazine, where I work, and WXYZ-TV, among others. And so home movies that show both life in Detroit and life in the suburbs in the mid-1960s, and also show the riot. But also there's going to be people's oral histories that they've given to the Detroit Historical Museum. There's a number of interviews we did on our own. There's found footage from various archives around the country and certainly in Michigan. So there's a whole host of ways that Brian Kaufman and Kathy Kalaszewski, the two main cinematographers, are putting this together, and they're really brilliant, and it's going to be a very good movie.
So how were these home movies? I mean, were they, revelatory in any way?
No, only in the sense that they, for the purpose of the movie, they show what life was like in the two separate societies, Black and white, in Metro Detroit in 1967. As you know, the Kerner Commission, which studied riots in America after the riots, said that America was heading to a Black and white society. It really existed then. And so the movies show people both in Detroit, white and black, and in the suburbs, white, enjoying life, having parties, having barbecues, kids acting goofy. And so they really show, again, they're a real period piece because of the nature of Super 8 film.
Sure, right.
And they also show what was really going on a ground level 50 years ago.
So when will we be able to see 12th and Claremont?
The premiere is March 30th as part of the Freep Film Festival. It's at the Fillmore on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. Tickets are on sale through Live Nation, and they're going fast, and it's going to be a really worthwhile event.
I'll be getting mine today, I think, because I don't want to miss that. It sounds great. Bill McGraw is working with the Free Press on that documentary. His article into the paper today is Bringing Detroit's Black Bottom Back to Virtual Life, and it's nice that Bridge loaned you out.
I'm happy they did.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Not too long ago, Model D published an article titled, Why Does Michigan Have a Thumb? We'll link to that article on our website. But we decided to call an expert to give us a simple explanation, and Randall Schetzel is a professor in geography and geological sciences at Michigan State University. I understand we have to take this story back at least 100,000 years to the most recent ice age. How much of Michigan was covered by glaciers?
Michigan was completely covered by glaciers, probably starting about 30,000 years ago, maybe even before that, and began to be uncovered about 24,000 years ago. The glaciers were completely gone by about 11,000 years ago.
Now, at their peak, how big were these glaciers?
Yeah, the glaciers in northern Canada were between 1.5 and 2 miles thick. Down here in southern Michigan, maybe only 1,000 to 1,500 feet thick.
Only. The glaciers have a lot to do with the landscape that we have today, but tell me how those glaciers changed things. How did that work?
They had a lot to do with the way the landscape exists today. Everything you see out there, hills, valleys, lakes, the Great Lakes themselves are all legacies of the glacial advances and retreats, and not just the last one, but there may have been as many as 10 to 15 previous advances and retreats about which we know very little. So this is a long-term process. The ice has been advancing over our state and retreating from it probably for the last couple million years.
So as they're growing, they're pushing things out of the way, and as they retreat, they're doing what?
Yeah, the glaciers begin in Canada, and they scraped Canada pretty much clean, which is why when you go up there, all you see is bedrock. All of that debris, all of that rock was scraped and crushed and dragged down here into the Great Lakes region, where it's deposited, and in many places, the thickness of those deposits in Michigan are hundreds of feet thick.
Let's talk about the Thumb. It's a peninsula with Saginaw Bay on the west side, Lake Huron on the east side. How or why did the Thumb form?
Well, we have to think about how the glaciers advanced into the state. They were sliding and flowing southward out of Canada, and they found some weak rocks called shales in the Lake Huron Basin. Those same shales existed in the Lake Michigan Basin. The glaciers preferentially dug those rocks out because they're softer and created those lake basins. When the ice was moving southward through Lake Huron, as we understand it, it would have hit a very hard rock layer in the Thumb called the Marshall Sandstone. The Marshall Sandstone is one of the hardest rocks in the Lower Peninsula, and it's at the surface in the Northern Thumb. In fact, they used to mine it there to make old grindstones for grist mills. It's such a hard and coarse rock. So the glacier hit that sandstone and couldn't scrape it away, so it actually split the advancing ice into one tongue that would have gone south toward Port Huron, down east of Detroit. The other tongue, or what we call lobe, would have been hived off and flowed westward into the peninsula, carving out Saginaw Bay.
Is that how other peninsulas were formed, such as Keweenaw or the two peninsulas of Grand Traverse Bay?
Absolutely. In fact, I was just telling my students the other day, I teach geography of Michigan, every peninsula in the Great Lakes is there because it is formed on harder rock, whether it's the Thumb or the Bruce Peninsula in Ontario or the Garden Peninsula in the UP, and certainly the Keweenaw Peninsula as well.
The Great Lakes are changing very slowly. For instance, Niagara Falls will continue to erode and move toward Lake Erie despite human efforts to stop it. What kind of changes do you think we'll see in the future given climate change as a factor?
Well, the jury's still out on what will happen to the Great Lakes due to forthcoming climate changes. Most of the models forecast lower lake levels, considerably lower lake levels. Although at the present time, as you know, the lakes are above normal. Most of the lakes are above normal. So we may be enjoying a nice period of high lake levels at the present time, but that's not expected to stay.
Hmm. Randall Schetzel is a professor of geography and geological sciences at Michigan State University. Hey, thanks for telling us about Michigan's Thumb and the other peninsulas.
Very happy to be on the show. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The state of Michigan's chief economist is retiring today. Jay Wortley worked for the state for 36 years, and he joins us now. First of all, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been involved in advising governors and legislatures on economic tax and revenue issues for a long time. How much did they listen through the years?
Oh, that's a good question. I think they listened in particular to our revenue forecasts, because that's not the easy thing to do. And if you put together a budget that's based on too much revenue, then that creates problems down the road. So I think over the years, a lot of attention was paid to the revenue estimates in particular.
Talking about that, I saw you were involved in all 53 consensus revenue estimating conferences that have been held since 1992. That conference requires those projections you were talking about. Outside economists are brought in also. How difficult is it to come to consensus?
It depends on what's going on in the economy. Some years it was very easy to come to a consensus because we were all in pretty much agreement. Again, under the consensus arrangement, revenue estimates were made by the Senate Fiscal Agency, the House Fiscal Agency, and then us here in Treasury. And we get together, do our independent estimates, then we get together and come to a consensus. Some years we had differences of opinion that was made it harder, but 53 conferences, we had 52 agreements. So that's a pretty good track record.
Well, the big question is, how good were the projections? How well have you and your colleagues done on those economic projections over the years?
Well, some years we were very good, and some years we were really bad.
And what happens when it's really bad besides, well, like you said, not getting revenues right for the state?
Yeah, the worst times were when going into a recession. It's very hard to predict the timing of when you're going to go into recession and how deep it's going to be. So probably the worst estimate was made in early 2007 and 2008 when we were headed into the Great Recession, and nobody anticipated it to be as severe as it was. So you just have to keep everybody up to speed on what's going on in terms of revenues. We track revenues on a monthly basis, and when things started to drop, we were telling people it was dropping fast. And so one of the goals as a revenue estimator and economist is you have to let people know what's going on as soon as possible. So the budget office and the governor and the legislature can make adjustments to the budget as soon as possible.
What kind of trends have you noted in how the state of Michigan manages its finances over the years?
Oh, well, I think things have improved greatly. And I think one of the things that we did that has made things a lot better is the Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference. Prior to the conference, which began in 1992, the legislature would make their own estimates, the governor would make his estimate, and then they would come to an agreement, the politicians would come to an agreement on the final revenues.
And not consulting economists at all? Or?
Well, I mean, sometimes they would, but sometimes when you're finally putting the budget together and you're making hard decisions on what to spend and what not to, at that point in time, it wasn't very popular to lower the revenue estimate, because it just made the budget decisions that much harder. But when you're going into a tough economic time, right, when you're putting the budget together, you may have to lower the revenue estimate.
Yeah, that could come back to bite you.
Yeah.
How has a term-limited legislature differed from past unlimited legislatures when it comes to understanding state finances?
It becomes more difficult. In the past, before term limits, you had legislators that were had been around a long time and understood the state's finance structure and tax structure. And now with term limits, you have a lot more newer people in the legislature, and it just takes time for them to learn all the intricacies of the tax structure.
I was sitting in on one of the consensus meetings one time, and one of the economists noted that being an economist might be the most boring profession outside of being a lawyer, maybe, that anybody had. What do you have to say to respond to that?
Oh, I think it's very interesting. I would disagree with that. One thing neat about the economy is it's very dynamic, and it's always changing. And our job is to foresee those changes and to keep good track of the economy and to see what's going on. And so I find that very interesting.
What's been your favorite part of the job?
Oh boy, favorite part of the job is all the neat people I've had to work with, and all the neat tax structure issues that I've got to help formulate. And so I've just worked on a lot of neat topics. But when it's all said and done, it's the people I've got to work with. It's just very special. State government employees are hardworking and dedicated, and I've worked with a lot of good ones. So it's been a lot of fun.
If you were to have an exit interview, I want to know what advice you would offer government officials or future governors and the citizens at large.
Just the importance of state government. It's sometimes hard to see what state government does for people, but state government does a lot. And again, the state employees are hardworking, and they do a great job of implementing the laws, and they don't always get a lot of credit for all the hard work they do.
That thing you mentioned about people not being aware of what state government does, that's a chronic a problem for the state, especially when you have new ideologues come in and say they want to, you know, shrink government even more. Do you have an answer for them?
No, just to be careful and make sure you know what, you know, what state government provides and does, and what will happen if those services are not provided any longer.
So what are you doing now?
I'm going to, me and my wife, we bought a house in Holland, Michigan, and we're moving to Holland, Michigan. And it's an old house, and we're going to fix it up. So we're looking forward to a new chapter in our lives.
That's Jay Wortley. He's Michigan's chief economist, and he retires today. All the best of luck to you.
Well, thank you very much.
We've seen recently an increase in attacks on Muslims, vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, the shooting of two Asian Indian IT techs, and so on in recent weeks. It's a dastardly trend that reminds people of the actions by white supremacist groups of the past. One of the infamous groups in Southeast Michigan was known as the Black Legion. David Sewick is a professor of history at Lansing Community College, and he joins us now. So you know about these guys. It's the 1930s, and Detroit has seen a large migration of white Southerners into the city. What philosophies did they bring with them?
Well, the Black Legion had the philosophy of white supremacy, as well as what we nowadays might call far-right politics. They were very strongly anti-union, and they were anti-Catholic, they were anti-Jewish, they were anti-black. And so they had some of the similar ideological beliefs of the Ku Klux Klan, which, of course, had been popular in this country for a very long time and had waxed and waned in terms of its popularity, in terms of people who had affiliations with it or membership in it. And the Black Legion was along very similar along those lines.
How were they different? Because there were, KKK was active in, for instance, Howell and some other places in Michigan.
One of the primary differences with the Black Legion would probably be how strongly anti-union they were. And you look at some of the people that the Black Legion members murdered, and they were union organizers. They were union organizers at well-known companies, Ford Motor Company, Hudson, to name a couple of the well-known cases that ended up having Black Legion members prosecuted. So I think the anti-union aspect of them certainly distinguishes them a bit from the Ku Klux Klan.
Do we have any idea how many members were in the Black Legion?
That's a good question, and estimates that historians have put out range widely. In fact, some historians would estimate it to be 20,000, 30,000. Others as high as 200,000.
Were most of them in Michigan?
Michigan and Ohio seems to be the center of the Black Legion.
So popular, I know, in Detroit, Pontiac, Flint as well.
Sure. Highland Park, Ecorse, the Southeast Michigan area as a whole.
So what did they do? What did they want?
They wanted America for Americans, to use their own terms. And what they branded themselves as was a group that was going to take immigrants, non-white Protestants, out of the competition for jobs, that they were going to return America to some sort of a Protestant white cultural identity. And the labor aspect, though, is very important. Keep in mind, this is the 1930s, this is Depression. The unemployment rate in Southeast Michigan was very high, varying really between 25 to as high as nearly 50% throughout, especially the first half into the middle part of the 1930s. And their membership really drew from people who were out of work, were looking for work, or who were in work but were afraid that they were going to lose their jobs. And so to tell those people that immigrants are the threat to your economic security, it was something that some people were willing to listen to.
How'd they recruit?
They would recruit on the shop floor in factories. They would hold meetings. They had a front group, if you will, that was called the Wolverine Republican League. They had the appearance of a very legitimate social group. They had a headquarters that they met in. They had a prominent attorney in Detroit, a gentleman by the name of Harry Marks, who was a well-connected attorney, had an office in the Guardian Building downtown, and in fact, his office address in the Guardian Building was their official mailing address. However, they had a meeting house. It wasn't theirs particularly. It was a space that they shared with others that the owners of the house rented out, and that building is actually still in Detroit. It was called the Finlander Temple. It was a former Masonic temple. It's on the corner of Waterman and West Lafayette in southwest Detroit. and it's still around. It's now a banquet hall called El Bosque.
Hmm. So how violent were they?
They were violent. They committed murders. They committed beatings. They had the very same type of actions that the Ku Klux Klan had.
They, in 1936, some of the top leaders murdered a man named Charles Poole. What did they have against Poole?
Well, that's an interesting story. So the Charles Poole murder is ultimately what exposed the Black Legion in quite a dramatic fashion, as the headlines were on the front of the Detroit newspapers. So Charles Poole's wife's brother-in-law was a man by the name of Lowell Rushing, and he was in the Black Legion. And Charles Poole's wife had been admitted into the hospital. She was pregnant, and doctors feared a miscarriage. Rushing had attended a Black Legion meeting and got the crowd whipped into a frenzy, accusing Poole of assaulting his wife
and causing the
potential miscarriage. So he gets the crowd whipped into a frenzy at this meeting. Harvey Davis, who was a local Black Legion leader, as well as Dayton Dean, who worked for the Detroit Public Lighting Department, also a member of the Black Legion, they are able to lure Poole out of his house, and they drive him to Dearborn Heights, and they murder him.
The premise was interesting, too. A new baseball group? Is that what a new baseball organization is what they were taking him to?
Yeah, it was
that was
something,
the story.
Yeah, it was something that existed actually around the state of Michigan, around the country at the time, something that where I'm from in Kalamazoo back in the day were called city baseball leagues. And these were mostly factory teams that had their own baseball teams. And this was a very big deal. This is how you could get hired into a factory. My grandfather used to tell me if you were a well-known shortstop or third baseman in Kalamazoo in the 1940s, you could get hired into a shop. And so they had lured Poole out of his house, telling him that he was going to go try out for one of these baseball teams.
So the rumor about Poole was completely made up. They killed him.
Mm-hmm.
One of the members of the Black Legion had a change of heart when he found out that the rumor about Poole beating his wife till she had a miscarriage was wrong. We should note part of the reason Poole was a target was he was Catholic.
Absolutely. In fact, Poole had been driven out of Kentucky previously by the Ku Klux Klan because he was Catholic.
So what happened after this one member of the Black Legion had a change of heart?
Sure. Well, witnesses saw men hauling or luring Poole out of the house, and the detectives that were put on the case called in pretty quickly Harvey Davis and Dayton Dean, and both of them actually ended up having, if not a change of heart, at least they talked to the detectives, and they talked quite fluidly, shall we say, because they started naming names. And one by one, the police called more people in for questioning, and before they knew it, they not only had the Poole murder case on their hand, but they also had some previous missing persons murder cases that had gone unsolved, or at least had been deemed case closed, that were opened back up. And the web of the Black Legion then was exposed.
And a lot of these people went to prison for life. The Black Legion fell apart. Where did its members turn then?
Well, those who went to prison served long terms. Other members, we don't know what happened to really what we would call the rank and file. Some of them probably just dissipated back into normal society. However, there are some well-known figures who were associated with the Wolverine Republican League, which was this political front group, if you will, for the Black Legion. And some of these folks had an interesting after story themselves.
1936 was not all that long ago. The children and grandchildren of Black Legion members are still alive, and presumably some of them are still living in this area. What kind of legacy has that group left in Southeast Michigan?
Well, that's a good question. I think the legacy of Southeast Michigan having a very strong labor movement, but also anti-labor movement and anti-labor sentiment. To get back to a point I made earlier about the power that the Black Legion had in disrupting organizing attempts. I don't know if we can necessarily say that that's a direct legacy of the Legion, but that political division that the Legion manipulated is certainly still around. And we look at the anti-immigrant sentiment that exists in communities across Southeast Michigan, but across the country as a whole, as the United States is now at a point where we have a large percentage of our population is immigrants. Anti-immigrant sentiment was a major issue in the political campaign we just went through. It's a major issue still with some of the executive orders that the current administration has issued. And I think that 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 struggle, if you will, for a defined American culture and what role that immigrants play in it is certainly something that we can recognize to this day.
There was a movie about the Black Legion starring Humphrey Bogart. That movie was screened recently in Lansing. You facilitated a discussion afterward. What was the reaction of the people who saw it?
The reaction was quite mixed, but at the same time very, I think, striking in the immediate connections that people were able to make with some of the themes in the movie to what's going on in our culture nowadays. People definitely brought up some of the dialogue in the movie that sounds very much like the dialogue that a lot of people in our country nowadays are professing against immigrants. There's one scene in that movie in particular where the character that Humphrey Bogart plays, his name is Frank Taylor, he goes to a recruiting meeting for the Black Legion, and the speech that the actor gives in character is very reminiscent to some of the stuff that we heard at the most recent presidential campaign, that America for Americans, America first. And there were certainly many people at our film screening last week who brought that up, that they recognized that connection to the present.
We've been talking about the Black Legion in Southeast Michigan. David Seawick is a professor of history at Lansing Community College. Thanks for letting us know about this.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening.